You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Wisconsin Wakes Up here. Back to Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
7:06 right now. We hope that your Friday is off to a great start. We are expecting some warmer temperatures as the weekend and into next week progresses. You should have a lovely day to go to a Brewers baseball game, by the way, Parker. It'll be, you know, probably in the 50s, but we'll take that, especially if we're looking at, you know, upper 60s and 70s by next week. I'm very excited for warm weather. Yesterday was a precursor for me. I'm ready to get rid of rain and snow and all of that, and I'm ready for some nice outdoor time because, well, I'm tired of being cooped up, let's be honest. And we need something good to look forward to in this world, like some sunshine and some outdoor time, Brian, because, well, the news, it sucks. Let's be honest.
The news always sucks. So speaking of, let's welcome to the suck and find out what's going on over in Iran. You know, the war trudges on, even though there is a ceasefire, maybe? I don't know. Not
question
really.
Marks.
Could be. All the questions. So some headlines from the Persian Gulf region. Tehran-backed Hezbollah says it targeted Israeli soldiers in Lebanon and in an Israeli border town. The attacks come as Israeli airstrikes across Lebanon threaten to derail the U.S.-Iran ceasefire.
Feels like that was very fragile if it's only taken a couple of small things to make it this fragile, right? To make it this unstable.
It was never a thing. And no. Israel started this whole thing. Whatever they have on Trump and whatever Netanyahu got him to do, and now they're not playing by the same rules.
No.
So.
No. Speaking of Netanyahu, he says Israel wants direct talks with Lebanon on disarming Hezbollah and insists Lebanon is not part of the ceasefire deal. The Lebanese prime minister will travel to Washington, D.C. in the coming days, according to a Lebanese government source and what they were telling CNN.
Well, a few vessels are traveling through the Strait of Hormuz, as analysts say it's still too risky to make the journey. President Trump has warned Iran against charging tolls, while Abu Dhabi's oil chief says the critical waterway is not open. And if we're not looking partisanly at this issue, Trump has no power to tell them what to do anymore. We've lost control of the Strait. The Strait was... And again, it bears repeating for the people in the back who still have their red hat covering their ears. The Strait was open until he started bombing. There were no tolls being charged. Vessels were getting through unencumbered. Everything was fine. So tell me again how you won. Tell me again.
In other headlines, I'm just going to leave that right there because we did not win. We are not winning. Negotiations between Iran and the U.S. are set to take place from Saturday in Islamabad. They will be the first talks between both sides since the war began. Now, these are the talks, remember, that the U.S. is sending its brain trust to.
Crack team.
We've got J.D. Vance who will be there, Steve Witkoff, and Jared Kushner who will also be in the room for these particular talks.
The Three Stooges. That'll be fun. All right, that's the Persian Gulf, but there is more stuff we need to know.
It's a wake-up call in more ways than one. Time for some you need to know.
Yes. Well, we talked about Governor Evers signing the online gambling bill. He was all about sports yesterday. Tony was wearing his athleisure, and he was signing a flurry of bills. And this one he signed, giving a Badger state funding with a little bit of tweak with the NIL bill, the name, image, and likeness bill, if you are not familiar. Governor Evers signed the legislation that is going to provide $14.6 million in taxpayer funding for the UW Athletic Department, along with codifying many existing NIL practices. It came with a partial veto to tweak some of the precise language regarding the funding. The governor loves to tweak the language. The partial veto removes what Evers described in his official letter to the assembly as, quote, potential confusion created by referring to maintenance in the funding that is intended to alleviate facility debt service. He said that the greater flexibility is necessary to ensure this funding can be used effectively and allow the system to maximize the state's investment. So UW-Madison is getting the bulk of this state funding for athletic facility debt service. The law does allocate an additional $200,000 each to UW-Milwaukee and UW-Green Bay's athletics departments for the same purpose. The partial veto did not affect any of the other aspects of the legislation, which formalizes existing rules around athletes' ability to profit off their name, image, and likeness. It also forbids athletes from endorsing tobacco, alcohol, gambling, or illegal activity, and creates a new public records exemption for NIL agreements and revenue allocations. So, and in, if you listened to the athletic director from UW-Madison, he said, listen, if we don't get some money, we can't compete with these other states that are helping, because, you know, you want, Madison is the marquee school of the state. Whether you want to, whether you went to Marquette or not, and don't want to admit it, yes, Madison is the marquee school, and part of that is the athletics program.
Well,
it, and I that's mean, what brings people in.
Exactly, and it's essentially just to keep the talent here. And if you know, let's be realistic. If you remember, and I'm going to be a little facetious here, but if you remember the Badgers football team from last year. They could use a little bit more talent coming in, right? But it gives athletes a chance to earn money while they're not in school instead of everyone making money off of them. It's also going to help the university stay competitive. And it's not just the football on Saturdays, right? It's going to be about recruiting. It's the facilities. It's national exposure. Mm-hmm. And it also then leads to the economy. Because big athletic programs, as you rightly pointed out, Brian, they're going to bring in real dollars and hotels. Restaurants, bars, local businesses. Yeah, it's all going to be affected on game days and surrounding game days, because it's more of a destination then when you have this type of money.
And yes, I know Madison is a research institution and there's a lot of brilliant minds there doing a lot of brilliant things. But the athletics department is the front door to the university.
Yeah.
That's what gets you national attention. People from people who didn't even go to Madison are watching Badger games.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. And if you're trying to field top teams that will keep donor money coming in and keep everything else coming in, you have to compete with these other states that are offering their athletes bigger NIL deals. And you could disagree with NIL all you want, but it's here to stay and it makes sense. So,
I mean, why shouldn't the athletes, though, be able to profit off of their own name, image, and likeness instead of other individuals profiting off of them? To me, that never made a whole lot of sense. And the fact
well,
that
the old argument is they're getting room and board. They're getting an education that would cost. I know, but the education,
know.
You know, the bill on the education is a couple hundred grand. So that should be enough. And it's not when you look at the millions of dollars, especially if you are
if you are
an athlete who is the face of the program. If you're a quarterback at a school and suddenly you're in Heisman contention, the amount of extra money you're bringing into that institution and the amount of money that institution is making on hats and jerseys and posters and everything that has your face on it, you should get a little cut of that.
Yeah. I mean, and let's be realistic.
So something for the effort.
Let's be realistic. College athletics is already a business. It's already a business. This is, I mean, that's what essentially what it is. It's run like a business. It is a business. So this is really just Wisconsin deciding to stay in it instead of falling way behind all of the other schools and then losing out on talent because they don't have these offerings.
Exactly. Hey, Melania had something to say yesterday, Jamie.
I have so much to say about this, but first,
well, let's get to it.
That's right. So First Lady Melania Trump, if you didn't see yesterday, blasted the lies that she said linked her to the disgraceful Jeffrey Epstein in a very extraordinary and some rare remarks from the White House. She was attempting to essentially distance herself from the convicted sex offender while calling on Congress to hold public hearings, allowing his victims to testify on Capitol Hill. Her statements directly undercut ongoing messages from former husband and the West Wing, renewing attention on a topic that was fading from public discourse because of this war with Iran. Now, a person familiar with the matter told CNN that Donald Trump was aware his wife planned to make Thursday's statement. The president, though, told MS Now that in an interview after her remarks that he did not know anything about it ahead of the First Lady's appearance.
Jamie, she doesn't talk to me about anything. We don't sleep in the same wing of the house. I knew she was going to say something. I thought it was going to be in that incoherent gibberish that she has. You know, she's been in this country a long time. Still sounds like she just got off the boat. I don't understand it.
Now, she said, quote, "I've never been friends with Epstein. Donald and I were invited to the same parties as Epstein from time to time, since overlapping in social circles is common in New York City and Palm Beach. To be clear, I never had a relationship with Epstein or his accomplice, Ghislaine Maxwell." And then she went ahead and called on Congress to provide a forum for Epstein's victims to testify on Capitol Hill, saying that each and every woman should have her day and tell her story to the public if she wishes, and that her testimony should be permanently entered into the congressional record. Melania also sought to downplay her relationship with Ghislaine Maxwell. The House Oversight Committee's top Democrat, who is Representative Robert Garcia, said in a statement shortly afterwards that he agrees with the First Lady's call for public hearings with the survivors of Jeffrey Epstein. He encourages Chairman Comer to come forward and respond to the First Lady's request and schedule a public hearing immediately. So here is why this was, to me, I'm not making light of Jeffrey Epstein. I'm making light of this particular situation because this had essentially died for this administration. The Epstein files, they were still lingering.
I disagree.
They were still lingering, but nobody was talking about them to the extent that they were because Donald started a war in Iran. So Congress wasn't talking so much about the Epstein files. They were trying to figure out these war power resolutions. People still wanted these hearings. They knew that they weren't going to happen. Then here comes Melania. And out of nowhere, basically to say, we didn't have a relationship. Let's bring this all to light. Let's bring these women to the Capitol and let's have these hearings. It was one of the most jarring situations I've ever seen. And by the way, yes, she did know Jeffrey Epstein. Yes, she did know Ghislaine Maxwell. There are photos of her and Donald Trump circulating all over. There are emails in those documents of her to Ghislaine Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell to Melania, and even Jeffrey Epstein wishing her a wonderful day. The emails prove it. I just found this to be hilarious yesterday on so many levels.
I found it despicable. It's rats from a sinking ship again. She's doing her best to, again, lie like everybody else. As you mentioned, emails, pictures, we have the receipts. And also, the victims of Epstein have already given their testimony.
Yes.
This is not their burden to have to go to Congress and tell their story. They've told their story. Their story has been ignored. So it's not on them to have to come out and run the investigation and put themselves in front. They've had their names leaked because the DOJ did not redact them. These women who were girls at the time of their victimization do not need to do any more.
No.
For this. This is all on the Justice Department now. It's all on the Republicans who keep burying this. And I don't think people forgot. I think we've had to put it on the back burner for now.
Yeah.
But it's still on the stove. She brought it back to the front. He didn't know. It's her
that's
now.
That's why I found it hilarious.
She sees the writing on the wall. She sees the writing.
That's why
knows.
I found it hilarious, by the way, because this administration is constantly contradicting itself. So I find that funny when they do that because they can never keep their story straight. My other question about this was, why now? Is she trying to get ahead of something? Is there something that's about to come that we're being prepared for that we're going to scream fake news about?
If he crosses Netanyahu, all these people have something on him and it's all coming back. We'll get to it maybe next hour, but Artemis is flashing down today. Don't forget the astronauts are coming home. We've got more to come because, as always, it is Daybreak and this is the Civic Media Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
722 right now. Thank you for joining us this morning. And yes, this is where we don't talk about politics for just a few minutes, and we talk about pop culture instead. Our senior producer, Frank, joins us for another edition of Swipe or Stay. How are you today?
I'm good. So about that politics thing, usually there are no stories that involve politics. There might be one that's a little spicy.
All right.
Saucy.
All right. I like spicy.
Frank throwing a curveball.
That's what I like to do. It's on a Friday. You have
to. Let's do it.
It's good, I promise. So here's Swipe or Stay. Here's how it's going to work. I'm going to read some pop culture headlines for Brian and Jamie. They're going to have to decide whether they want to stay and hear more or if they want to swipe on to the next one. In the event of a tie, producer Parker will be the tiebreaker. So we're going to go to number one. I've looked at it every which way to see if there's a vague way to write this, and there just isn't. We may have a presidential son's cage match.
Oh, I'm in.
Stay.
So move over, Dana White and the UFC. We have some new challengers for the White House lawn. Here's a message from Hunter Biden.
Hey, guys. Hunter Biden here. I just got a call from Andrew Callahan. He asked me to come out on the Channel 5 Carnival Tour at the end of the month. I think he's trying to organize a cage match, me versus Eric and Don Jr. I told him I'd do it. 100% in if he can pull it off, and if he can't, I'm still coming.
We may have a cage match between Hunter Biden.
Is that fair though? It's 2-1.
The two of them look are half a human.
Look, Hunter's pretty confident in it. Now, my question is, does he get to take his laptop into the octagon with him?
Somebody has to throw it over the top of the fence.
And then I would hope so.
Goes after Eric's big choppers and thwap.
Now, we are a news talk show. So for research, my question for you all is, if this was a pay-per-view fight, how much would you be willing to pay to watch it?
$1.75.
$1.50, as much as the pimento cheese sandwich at the Masters. No.
As long as it's covered on the company card. Whatever.
Yeah, we could get one password
for the
company.
I'd chip in at least $20 for it.
Okay.
I'd throw 20 bones in.
It'd be so good. And by good, I mean it would be just a train wreck.
And the minute he messes up Don Jr.'s hair, the crying starts. And
well, that's what we may see some cheating. Actual fireworks if this happened. It never will.
No.
But it would actually be great.
Yeah, it really would.
Because Hunter's going to bring in that former crack addict energy. Those guys fight.
They're scrappy.
Story two.
Story two. A Rock and Roll Hall of Famer has tied the knot for the fifth time.
Wow, a four-time loser coming back. I'm going to stay.
I'll stay.
Any guesses? It is a man. I will give you that.
Rock and Roll times.
Hall of Famer. If five times wasn't enough of a hint to tell you that it was a man.
It's got to be somebody
older.
James
Brown is dead.
I'm going to say Rod Stewart.
Oh,
that's a
good guess.
Rod Stewart's a good guess.
Thank you. It's not Rod Stewart. No,
that's a good guess.
All right.
Fleetwood Mac founder and drummer Mick Fleetwood.
Oh my God.
Has gotten married for the fifth time at the age of 78.
Oh my God.
He was married to the same person twice, by the way.
That's ridiculous.
That's weird.
Now here's the deal. I think I speak for everyone when I say cheers to the happy couple. And hopefully he can make some more hits like when he had an affair with Stevie Nicks and made the Rumors album.
Yes.
Okay. I don't understand. I don't understand the marriage, the 2-5. I don't understand that.
Look, man, if I was married four times already, I'm 78 years old. The last thing I want is marriage.
Yeah, because how much of your fortune have you had to give away to these ladies?
He's not going to be one of those really old guys now in Hollywood who goes and has like a set of twins, right? Because
you see
De Niro do that. You see like De Niro did that, and you saw
Tony Randall,
Pacino.
Pacino did it. No,
maybe it's an Italian thing. I don't know.
Look out, Frank.
All right, let's
move on. The NCAA is looking into new eligibility rules.
Ooh. Swipe.
Yeah, we'll swipe on that one.
We have an actress that got kicked off a Delta flight.
Ooh, stay.
Stay.
This will probably be our last story of the day. Actress Natasha Lyonne.
Yes.
She was in Orange is a New Black, American Pie movies.
Yeah.
She was booted from a Delta flight for lack of cooperation earlier this week. Witnesses say that she was out of it in first class, ignoring repeated requests from flight attendants to buckle up and stow her laptop before takeoff. Apparently, the situation escalated. So here's the deal. The plane taxied for a bit and then had to turn right back around and dock just so actress could get kicked off.
Oh,
wow.
The flight was delayed for an hour.
Oh, those poor passengers.
Because she refused to leave the flight. Apparently, she was so confused, she asked, "Where are we?" before exiting the plane. Oh, by the way, this flight came after she attended the Euphoria premiere.
She has had some issues with mental health struggles and drug addiction, though. So hopefully, this means that, you know, she's not unwell, or if she is, she gets the help she needs, because she has had to battle quite a few times over the years.
But come on, it's easy for you to be caring from a distance. If you're sitting on that plane,
I'd be
throwing her out the window myself.
Oh yeah, I'm super pissed in that moment, because I'm like, you are backing me up, but
I'm heckling her. I'm calling TMZ. I'm never watching another one of her projects. And I'm also asking if I can have her first class seat, because she has inconvenienced me beyond belief.
Yes.
Frank, another great week of Swiper Stay.
We had some good ones.
Yeoman's work, Frank. Congratulations.
Cheers to guys, let's all hope for a cage match.
We could go into the weekend with that dream.
It would be better. It would be better than the Masters.
All right, when we come back, Wisconsin has a teacher shortage. What are we going to do about it? We'll figure it out on the Civic Media Network.
This statewide impact. It's Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
Good morning and welcome to the Civic Media Network. Thank you so much for joining us today on Daybreak. Remember, if you want to join the conversation, you can call or text us at 1-855-752-4842, 1-855-75-CIVIC. We would love to hear from you on this Friday. And just a quick reminder, Brian, that we would love people to go over to our social medias, because we have those now.
We do.
Yeah, over on Facebook and Instagram. Give us a follow. Just do a search for Daybreak with Brian and Jamie. You can stay informed with everything we're doing on the show, and sometimes we post some other fun stuff about us, because we're not all about politics. We like to do other things too. Sometimes
listen, any chance I get, I'm not gonna lie, I think I'm not as different from most people, where there comes a point where it's like, I can't listen to any more political stuff. In my personal life, I'm obviously always monitoring things so we can talk about them on the show. I'm looking at the news, but there comes a point where it's like, I need to think about anything else.
Right.
Anything.
Yes.
That's why I've just, on Sunday mornings, I've stopped listening to a little, to as many news shows, and just take Sunday morning. But you know what I am always thinking about, Jamie, especially as the school year winds down, and coming from the classroom as I did, what's going on with teachers, not only in Wisconsin, but in the everywhere.
Yeah.
But Wisconsin is facing a teacher shortage, and one of the main contributors to the shortage is teacher retention, which is keeping young teachers working in the state. Now, that's the biggest problem, according to a new report released last week by the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. According to the report, almost 1,700 teachers who finished their training in Wisconsin in 2023 and 24 did not go on to teach in Wisconsin schools. So, that's an issue. How do we keep young educators in Wisconsin for the long haul? Heather Dubois is the executive director of Wisconsin Public Education Network, a nonpartisan alliance of parents, educators, and others from across the state who are committed to the ongoing success of public schools. She joins us now to share some possible solutions. Heather, thanks for being here. We appreciate your time this morning. When we talk about teacher shortages, what does that really mean, and how is it affecting Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, good morning. Thank you for having me. And thanks for waking up to tackle one of the biggest questions our kids in their public schools have faced for many, many years in Wisconsin and nationally. Why is it that we have this persistent challenge in attracting and retaining educators here? There are so many reasons for this, and unfortunately, the trail of breadcrumbs seems to lead straight back to the state capitol every time. But you know, the fact is, when we can't keep teachers in our classrooms, students suffer. We see bigger class sizes. We see what we call churn in the education world, you know, lots of staff turnover that makes it, you know, that has a big impact on school climate and students and families' experiences as they go through their academic careers. We see, relationships come and go, and that has a huge impact on teaching and learning and environments and on the way a student, processes information as well. And overall, the main impact is that we are just not able to provide the sort of education that we all strive to provide for all of the kids, which is, you know, consistent and reliable and excellent from preschool to college. And so this is a serious crisis across all of our districts, and we see districts scrambling to pick up the pieces by asking voters to increase the amount that they're paying locally to fund our public schools, since the state isn't paying its full share. And, it's an unsustainable model, right? Like, this is an irresponsible way to do school funding. And so voters get frustrated, taxpayers get frustrated, parents and educators were already frustrated. And the cycle just seems to get deeper and deeper the longer we perpetuate these inequities.
Heather, right now, Wisconsin has a lot of emergency licensed teachers in classrooms. And so when we're looking at what's happening on the day to day, what does that actually mean for the quality of education that our kids are getting in our schools?
Right. Well, I have nothing disparaging to say about emergency licensed teachers. We are deeply grateful for the service that they're providing. But, they are often not as adequately
prepared.
It's
like a stopgap, right?
It's a stopgap measure and a necessary one. And the real question is, why are there still so many hurdles to, you know, letting qualified educators, you know, get licensed expediently, or to allow, you know, retired teachers to reenter the classroom to help fill in these gaps as well? The state has created some barriers to doing that, which makes it harder to get the most qualified educators in front of students. But I think the bigger question for me is why are teachers leaving after between that 5 to 8 year mark? And I think the answer is, you know, simple. They can't afford to stay. They can't afford to raise families in the communities that they want to live and teach in. They can't afford childcare for their own children if they've started to have children by this time. And, when we look at what this report tells us about diminishing teacher pay, teachers are making less today than they were in 2010 when we adjust for inflation. That is not okay. These are highly qualified professionals who should be compensated as such.
Well, there's a lot of talk, especially amongst teachers, who say they're not in it for the money. And money is the easy answer and the logical answer as to why the retention problem exists. But there's other factors that play into that besides the money, because I think a lot of teachers would work not for what they're making now, but for a good wage. But there's a lot of different factors that come into those. What are some of those other things that are affecting the retention other than money?
Okay, well, I hear what you're saying, but I don't want to poo-poo the question of money.
Oh, I'm not money poo-pooing.
Money is the biggest answer
the money.
And the correct one.
But there's also classroom size, and there's classroom there's discipline action. There's a lot of other things that play into this that create that churn where people are then leaving, even if they were making the money, the environment is not conducive in a lot of places to retain those teachers.
Right. But then we have to ask the question, why is the environment not conducive?
Correct.
Why are the class sizes so big? Why is it so hard to design and implement disciplinary structures that allow all kids to meet all kids where they are and make sure that they are actively supported in every classroom? Often it's because we don't have enough support staff in our buildings. We don't have enough one-on-one supports for some of the kids who have special needs in some school districts. We don't have large enough or adequate enough facilities in some of our schools to meet some of these needs. And unfortunately, often, these are questions of inadequate funding or inadequate resources in the district as well. Things like school and district climate and teacher preparation are absolutely critical to the success of educators, to the retention of educators, and to, whether or not we're creating thriving and joyful environments for our kids in their schools. So, these are the most important things. But we need to create the conditions that are necessary for us to implement those with fidelity in order to, have a good solid ground. And that's really where I think Wisconsin has failed to meet the needs of its kids and its public schools, because our teachers know what to do, they're trained to know what to do, and then they enter teaching and learning environments where the conditions have not been met for them to do what they were trained to. And so I think that's frustrating for young educators. And I think that, when they're then asked to, pay more for their health insurance, to, do all of these extras and outside of school things, they are often working multiple jobs, and not just during the summer when they have a little bit of flex time, but during the school year as well. It just becomes unsustainable for them. And we hear that story so many times. And I think, our friends at WEAC have outlined this, for years and have been warning us that, we are not meeting the needs of our educators. And there are all kinds of disparities and gender inequities in the field of education, which also contribute to these issues.
Heather, how much of an issue was Act 10 in 2011? Because that took away the teacher's right. I taught in a place where we had a strong teachers union. Don't have that in Wisconsin. How much, if that were to go away, which it won't, but how much would that change the dynamic? Because then teachers would be able to advocate for themselves and not count on, let's hope the voters give us a referendum. Let's hope the assembly decides to give us some money.
Act 10 was absolutely devastating for Wisconsin public schools and Wisconsin public schools environments. It came with kind of a 1-2 punch of both taking away of educators' rights and their right to collectively bargain for their own working conditions, but also the deepest cut to public school that we've ever seen in any state in one swoop. And our kids are still paying the price for that. We're currently in our 18th year in a row of state funding that hasn't even kept pace with inflation from the last year. When we adjust for inflation, we're about $3,500 per student behind where we were in state spending in 2009. That's absolutely unconscionable. And so what this report shows is that teacher pay has declined in a similar way. And we don't need fewer students. Even when enrollments decline, we still need to have enough students to staff every grade in our class buildings. And so the needs have increased, but the funding has not kept pace with that. So it really is a serious crisis. And I think, restoring collective bargaining rights to teachers would be a huge step forward in resolving some of the problems that we see today, in addition to adequately funding our public schools.
Heather Dubois, the executive director of the Wisconsin Public Education Network, joins us, wisconsinnetwork.org, if you want to check out their organization. But early on in this conversation, we have just a couple minutes left. You mentioned the referendums. We saw the referendums in several districts pass on Tuesday. But at the same time, we also saw some school districts that are looking at having to dissolution or consolidate. So how much pressure is that now putting on districts when it comes to actually paying and retaining teachers?
It's huge. We hear from superintendents and school and building leaders every day who are just absolutely distraught that they cannot afford to pay teachers as much as neighboring districts, that their voters are not able to sustain, you know, increases in their property taxes and have rejected referenda. They're looking at cuts. They're looking at even more consolidation, which is not good for kids or families either. You know, we've got districts that are so big in this state. We've got 421 districts in Wisconsin, and most of them are rural and sparse, and kids are already on the bus for a long time during the day. Consolidation is not the one size fits all answer it might look like from a distance. And it's also not that cost saving when you factor in the cost of transportation and, you know, kind of the costs on teachers and families when they have to move around like that.
Heather, unfortunately, we're out of time.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. That's all right. Thank you for joining us this morning. Heather Dubois is the Executive Director of Wisconsin Public Education Network. WisconsinNetwork.org is the website. Heather, thanks very much for your time and your opinions. We appreciate it.
Yep.
When we come back, there is so much more because this is Daybreak and this is the Civic Media.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
7:52 right now. Thank you for joining us on the Civic Media Network. And yes, Brian, it is time for a bit of a civics lesson today.
I know. This is, you know, normally, like in school, you follow your curriculum. But sometimes there are electives. And mm-hmm. I asked for an elective on mm-hmm. this one because it's something that's come up. We'd been talking earlier in the week about the 25th Amendment, and that's what everybody's harping on,
yep.
the 25th Amendment, which doesn't, you know, if you can't remember, Section 4 of the 25th Amendment, the vice president and the cabinet has to call for the removal of the president. Well, then I started doing a little more reading and hearing a little bit more about Article 2, Section 4. And I went to our professor and I said, Professor Martinson, can we do an elective on Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution? Because I think this might be a little more apt
and
for
this,
what we're talking
this
about.
This might actually be one that if the Democrats would gain control of the House and Senate in the midterms, that they may lean into just a little bit more. And let me be clear. I had to do a little digging into the Library of Congress for this. Nothing excites
right.
me more. And that's totally okay, by the way, because here at Daybreak, we do all the hard work for you, so you can just sit back and listen to what we're about to say. But Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution essentially explains how top government officials can be removed from office. Now, what it essentially says is that the president, vice president, and other civil officers, meaning the cabinet, can be removed yes. after impeachment and conviction for things like treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. High crimes and misdemeanors doesn't just mean breaking the law. It can also mean abuse of power, corruption, or serious misconduct.
Say it again.
So here's how the process works. There's two steps, which makes it so much easier than the 25th Amendment. The House of Representatives has to vote to impeach, which is basically bringing the charges. Then the Senate has to hold a trial and needs a two-thirds vote to remove someone from office. Now, the system was designed as a final checkpoint on power, especially if a leader abuses their position.
We don't have any of that.
No, nothing like that right now. The idea actually comes from British history, where lawmakers held government officials accountable. The founders added this in 1780. Crazy thought, right? Like actually holding somebody accountable. But the founders actually added this in 1787 as a last resort to protect the country. The courts generally do not get involved, so impeachment is handled almost entirely by Congress. And over time, it's been clear that impeachment is more about political wrongdoing than just criminal charges. Now, one early example of that involves Andrew Johnson, and this shows how difficult it is to remove a president. In current times, this section has been directly applied to Donald Trump.
Now,
yes, so Trump became the first president in U.S. history to be impeached twice, back in 2019 and 2021. The charges included abuse of power, obstruction of Congress, and incitement of insurrection. In both of those cases, the Senate did not reach the two-thirds vote needed to convict, which is why he was able to run again.
Mm-hmm.
So he was not actually removed from office. The cases also showed how much disagreement there can be over what counts as high crimes and misdemeanors. They also reinforced that impeachment applies to individual officials, not an entire administration. That's another key takeaway in all of this. A president can still be impeached and tried for actions taken while in office, even after leaving office. Now, that's a key because we remember what the Supreme Court did, right? You might be thinking, did they change all of that? To be clear, I told you I did a lot of digging on this one. The Supreme Court of the United States has not eliminated impeachment. It has changed, however, the landscape around accountability. So in Trump versus United States, the court ruled that presidents have broad protection from criminal prosecution for official acts. Now, that's not going to apply just to Donald Trump, to be clear. That's going to apply to all presidents from here on out. So The Supreme Court did Trump a favor, but they've also done a favor to all other presidents who come after him. The court
said, but a big disservice to the country. Would that be correct?
Yes, that
assuming?
Is also correct. Yes, because the court said the presidents cannot be prosecuted for core constitutional duties and have presumptive immunity for other official actions. It also said presidents can still be prosecuted for unofficial acts, but it doesn't clearly define what that line is, which creates all of this confusion and makes it so much harder to hold a president actually accountable. Now, some particular critics say that this ruling literally just builds new legal barriers to things like Article 2, Section 4 that we're talking about.
Right.
But at the same time, others warned that it could also encourage abuse of power because actions could be defended then as official. The decision was that 6-3 majority. We remember when that came down. The country was appalled. There were so many people who were upset about that. Now, practically speaking, Article 2, Section 4 could make impeachment an even more important tool, but it also makes it a little bit more complicated to use. Essentially, Article 2, Section 4 is still intact, but between politics and some of the new legal protections, holding a president accountable is going to be harder in practice, but not impossible. That's going to also be the key.
Well, thank you, Professor. This was a fine elective. I'm glad I chose it over basket weaving and golf. But it's something different. So the 25th Amendment, probably not going to happen. Impeachment come November, again, could actually lead to a conviction this time.
And that's why
if enough things change in the Senate.
That's right. And that's why it's going to be so important for people to vote. Because remember, in all of these instances, it takes a two-thirds majority vote. So you're going to have enough people in on who believe that this needs to be done, Democrats, or even if you can bring Republicans into the fold, who are going to have to vote accordingly.
And I'm going to project. I know this is extra credit.
Yes.
But if things go the way indicators show that they will go in November and Democrats take control back of the House and the Senate, there will be at that point, I think, enough Republicans who see the writing on the wall and say, this is over for us. And I haven't been comfortable backing this guy for a while, but I was afraid of, you know, that may make the flip.
Yep.
And that would be great. All right. If you're listening on WMDX, see you later. Where you go listen to Stephanie Miller or use your good judgment and come to YouTube or the Civic Media Facebook page and listen to the final hour of this program. If you're leaving, have a good weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday. If you're staying for hour number three, you will not.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.